Hello and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola and I am here once again. Although I want to thank Brett Ehrlich and Francesca Fiorentini for sitting in for me on Monday. They had an awesome show. I've gotten very good feedback about it. So thank you to them, but thank you as well for joining me on Less Super Tuesday, the re-Tuesday-ing. We're gonna be having a whole bunch of primaries again later on today. There will of course be live coverage on the network. But before we get to all that, there is a lot of news to cover, including quite a bit that bears potentially on today's contest. And Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ is gonna be joining me in just a little bit to do that. But I also want to touch base with Mike Bloomberg. He's a guy who's been incredibly frustrating throughout this primary process. And he's got one little bit more sand thrown in the eyes of his own supporters. Wait until we get to this. We're gonna close out the show with that. And there's so much to get to, but I do want to touch base with the situation with coronavirus, because it has been a few days since I've talked about that. So that's actually where we're gonna start. If you're concerned about COVID-19, Fox has got an update for you. You shouldn't be worrying about the numbers, who's getting infected or anything like that. You should be angry at the person who caused this all, the Chinese. And this new narrative has gone like wildfire through the right. Take a look at some of the examples just from like the past 12 hours. So Kevin McCarthy, House Majority Leader, he had this tweet. Everything you need to know about the Chinese virus can be found on one regularly updated website. So you didn't need, it doesn't say Chinese on the website. Why'd you say that? But it wasn't just him. Tucker Carlson tweeted, "We must remain calm but not complacent about the Chinese virus. We addressed it on tonight's show. We hope you'll watch if you missed it." So look, I like to some extent that he was cautioning restraint in that video, but why suddenly the Chinese virus talk? By the way, I checked on Twitter to see if he had previously talked about it in that way. There were no references to be found. But they're not the only ones. It has also made its way to the morning programming on Fox News. Here's a bit of Fox and Friends.
The most encouraging thing is actually happening out of China, who started this whole thing. They were about 1,000 cases a day. They had very few. They had 14 field hospitals closed yesterday. 70% of the Chinese cases, everybody had to have recovered. Only 19 new infections. So
actually worked,
even though they started it and have yet to apologize.
If you're young.
Sometimes I watch the news and I just wanna like seriously sit down with the anchors and ask, are you like an actual baby? What do you mean they started it and they haven't apologized? That was an adult man paid a salary to sit with a tie on and say they didn't apologize. That's true. They might be a little bit distracted by the fact that thousands of their people have died. And they might be a little bit less concerned with apologizing to the world for something that they are still grappling with. And so look, that is a ridiculous spin to put on this continuing international issue. But the fact is that these three sources, so one of the most highly ranked elected Republicans, they got Tucker Carlson, that's the night on Fox, they got Fox and Friends, that's the morning on Fox. All of them want you to turn your attention to the unique Chinese nature of this. Because people, hadn't acknowledged that? We haven't already seen ridiculous xenophobia and racism inside of the United States against anyone who either is or hypothetically looks like they might be Chinese. No, we've already had far more than enough of that. People being harassed, attacked, and then just random businesses being hurt by this. I saw a post by someone whose family runs a Chinese restaurant saying that their business is down by more than 50%. They didn't come in with like a fresh delivery of eggs from Wuhan yesterday. There's no connection there. And yet this community is being hurt on a daily basis just because of where the virus originated. And that's not enough. But obviously we know what this is about. Kevin McCarthy, Tucker Carlson, and to a lesser extent, the dimwits at Fox and Friends, they want you to know that, look, you might be starting to get frustrated with the government response to COVID-19. You might think that Trump has surrounded himself with lackeys who don't know anything about science and they're not taking it seriously. Don't think about that. Don't focus on that. Just get mad at the Chinese. It's their one move. It is when you are frustrated with the domestic situation that you're faced, turn your attentions to some outsider. Look at them with suspicion, anger, resentment, fear. That's how they expect to get out of this. And it is at the end of the day, not about dealing with this crisis, but with protecting their dear leader. And that is where we turn next, actually. Let's turn to Donald Trump. Donald Trump's response to COVID-19 so far has been incredibly frustrating if you want a government that takes this seriously. Now, you probably saw some of his press conference last Friday where he said things like this. I have great people, experts, including our vice president who's working 24 hours a day on this stuff. They would like to have the people come off there. He's talking about a cruise ship where a couple dozen people have been infected with COVID-19. I'd rather have the people stay, but I'll go with them. I told them to make the final decision. I would rather, because I like the numbers being where they are, I don't need to have the numbers double because of one ship that wasn't our fault. That was not like some rave, well, I guess it is technically a raving lunatic. That was not some random raving lunatic. That was the president of the United States saying that his medical professionals are saying we need to get these people off of this cruise ship so that we can treat them and make sure that it doesn't spread. There's like 3,500 people on the ship and he doesn't want that. Why? Because he has a better understanding of the medical of the situation there? No, but because he doesn't want the numbers changing. The numbers in an absolute sense are not changing. Those people are infected. They just aren't in the United States yet. And that's what he's concerned about. What he should be concerned about is what he and others around him are actually doing because, and this was talked about on yesterday's show, it seems like a lot of high profile Republicans are coming into contact with people who have been exposed to COVID-19 recently. You probably saw that Trump has apparently been exposed or potentially exposed. He shook hands with CPAC chairman Matt Schlapp at the CPAC conference last week, during which Schlapp engaged with an attendee who has since tested positive for the coronavirus. So we knew that, but that's not the only way that he was potentially exposed to this virus that up until now he has not taken very seriously at all. He had contact with two Republican congressmen before their announcements that they were entering self-quarantine after learning that they had previously been exposed to someone diagnosed with coronavirus. His representative Doug Collins of Georgia shook hands with Trump last Friday when the president traveled. Matt Gaetz of Florida flew on Air Force One with Trump on Monday. Both of them have now self-quarantined. And there's a bit of a dark irony to Gaetz's situation because you might recall that he thought it would be a funny joke last week to wear a gas mask on the floor of the House because everybody was like freaking out about this virus when it's really not a big issue. So he's now in self-quarantine. One of his constituents has since died of COVID-19 and now he theoretically could have been exposed. Now, obviously, we hope that none of them have been infected, that no one additionally will be infected. But perhaps if they're not and they go through this self-quarantine procedure, maybe they will come out of it taking it a little bit more seriously, thinking that maybe this is not just joke fodder, like to make a meme or something like that. Maybe this is a little bit serious. But maybe they're not actually learning that because despite the fact that Donald Trump has had now three interactions with people who might have been infected with COVID-19, according to Stephanie Grisham, technically the White House press secretary, quote, the president has not received COVID-19 testing because he has neither had prolonged close contact with any known confirmed COVID-19 patients, nor does he have any symptoms. President Trump remains in excellent health and his physicians will continue to closely monitor him. So look, the fact that he shook hands with someone does not mean that he was necessarily infected with it. Lots of people hypothetically interacted with those people and they will not be infected by it. And so there is no reason for us to freak out. But it is a very weird statement to say that Donald Trump, a known germaphobe, hypothetically is not being tested for it. And honestly, I can't prove this. I can't, you know, read either Trump or Stephanie Grisham's mind, but I will say, I don't believe them. I don't think that Donald Trump, a guy who had been obsessed with Ebola online for a couple of years, hypothetically could have been exposed and he's just gonna ride this thing out. An elderly man is just gonna ride out COVID-19. I don't believe it at all. But they do want to put forward this idea that you shouldn't be worried. Let's not freak out about this. Trump's not even gonna get tested. And think about, again, what we've always said, the message that is sending to his base is, don't worry about it. Like, sure, maybe you interacted with someone, but like, unless you feel really sick, maybe just go about your day. Just, you know, hang out, go to your job, whatever. You don't have to worry about this. I mean, after all, Trump isn't worrying about this. Again, it is sending out a message to his own base, the only people who will trust Trump or Stephanie Grisham, that this is not something that you need to seriously worry about. Look, I hope that none of them are infected with it, but I really do hope that they start to take this seriously. So far, I have not gotten that impression from literally anyone involved with the response to COVID-19 here in the United States. And that is something that desperately needs to change. We still have people who are infected. We still have deaths that are happening in the United States. This needs to be met with a serious approach, and we have not seen that, even as more and more Republicans are potentially being exposed. Okay, with that, we are gonna take a short break, but when we come back, Emma Vigeland's gonna join us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Last night at his Fox News town hall, Bernie Sanders was asked about concerns that have been expressed about Joe Biden's mental state. Here's how he responded.
Senator, this isn't a personal attack, but it gets to Nina's question. And the question of Joe Biden's mental acuity is not something that just comes up anywhere. Democrats have brought this up, including Senator Cory Booker, who endorsed Joe Biden today. Take a listen.
You just said that 2 minutes ago. Are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Being for
him. Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
I think that Castro has some really legitimate concerns about, can he be someone in a long, grueling campaign that can get the ball over the line? And he has every right to call that out. There are definitely moments where you listen to Joe Biden and you just wonder.
Are we afraid to say that a lot of his sentences don't make sense, that he's having trouble completing thoughts?
Senator, your thoughts?
I'm not going to go at that level in attacking. Joe and I have, you know, that's for people to decide. All I can say is Joe and I have very significant political differences. And I'm not going to be making, you know, personal attacks on Joe. That's not what I do.
And joining us now to discuss of Rebel HQ, Emma Vigeland, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Glad to have you here. We're going to be talking a little bit about Joe Biden today. So what did you think about Bernie's handling of that question?
You know, when I read it, I didn't like the handling, but hearing how he responded there, I think he did the right thing. He's put in a really tough spot. By the way, great question by Brett Barron. Never thought those words would come out of my mouth, but I think it's really important to point out that this isn't coming from Donald Trump. This isn't coming from, you know, Breitbart. This was pointed out by Democratic candidates and the media, the candidates that are now endorsing Joe Biden, that Biden clearly has some issues with his cognitive decline. I'm not diagnosing him. I'm not a doctor, but he's unable to say things clearly. He's forgetting things in the middle of his sentences. And there's a reason that he's been in hiding since his massive win on Super Tuesday. This isn't because, you know, he's incubating or anything like that. It's because his campaign thinks that he needs to be shielded from public scrutiny. And that's the only way that he's going to borrow Cory Booker's words, carry the ball over the line. And I think that that's important to point out. But Bernie Sanders, look, he gets attacked as being divisive no matter what he does. So he has to be extra careful to not cast dispersions onto other candidates like Joe Biden, even if it's fair.
Yeah, and look, I can't diagnose anyone either. And I understand that once the idea is in your head, you start to interpret things based on that. But like, for instance, there's a video going around this morning of Joe Biden interacting with someone asking him about gun rights. And Biden refers to AR-14s. And so is that a slip of the tongue? Is that an inability to come up with the term? I honestly don't know, but it does seem weird that like the only person who could theoretically be hurt by a conversation about Joe Biden's, you know, whatever the state of his brain is at this point, is Bernie Sanders. Like if he brings it up, he's gonna be the bad guy who's not showing unity, when we know that if Bernie Sanders was regularly having trouble expressing himself and remembering things, there is absolutely no way that MSNBC would not be full of people discussing what it represents and why are the Bernie bros still sticking with him when he's definitely lost a step.
Or, I mean, just to take a small tangent, if Bernie Sanders lied about being arrested in apartheid South Africa and then his campaign admitted that he lied, we haven't heard anything about that. But to bring it back to Joe's, you know, obvious, I think, cognitive decline, this is going to be a huge problem in the general election. The media may think now all of a sudden it's uncouth to talk about now that he's the centrist front runner and they want to stop Bernie Sanders. But people who aren't ideologically aligned with the Democratic Party, who don't worship at the altar of the institution, are not going to see it like that. Look, you know, Joe Rogan, I don't agree with everything he said, but he's a great kind of barometer for the apolitical average voter, average person. Was just saying, listen to him talk for 1 second and was like, no, this guy can't be president. That's gonna be so many people's reactions. When I looked up, I was looking up Joe Biden YouTube videos to do some research. Top suggested search, Joe Biden Alzheimer's. So you may think it's unfair. I don't think it's unfair at all, but fine, make that argument, Democratic establishment, media, whatever. It doesn't matter. This is politics, and this is going to be a huge liability if he's going up against Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I know that they'll say like, how dare you bring this up? You're giving ammunition if Biden is the nominee, but like, first of all, that's already gonna happen. And second of all, we're giving you a chance to possibly avoid going down a road that might be very difficult electorally. We'll see if they'll listen. I assume that they will not. But I want to turn to one other topic involving Joe Biden. Axios recently was provided some indication of what a Joe Biden cabinet might look like if he becomes the nominee and somehow manages to become president. So overall, it said that Biden advisors describe a return to normal plan, a reversal of President Trump's unorthodox improvisational style. Biden wants known, trusted people around him, many from the Obama years, and we have some specific examples of this. And so, Emma Vigeland, I wanted to get your response to some of these names that have been brought up. John Kerry would love to take a new cabinet position devoted to climate change, or might even accept a curtain call to return as Secretary of State.
Oh, okay, yeah. John Kerry was just quoted this morning talking about how Bernie Sanders has never met a socialist authoritarian he doesn't like. I'm paraphrasing a little bit there, but that was the gist of the quote. So we can expect more troubling support for coups in Bolivia and just complete silence on many other issues involving the ousting of leftist leaders in South America, as well as continued aggression overseas, like we saw under John Kerry, under Obama. So yeah, that's my reaction. And also just the idea of the return to normalcy, the complete fantasy land that the Biden campaign and so many in the Democratic electorate are operating in. Yeah. The normalcy is what led to Trump. Why do you think normalcy in the way that you're painting it is going to beat Donald Trump, especially when Joe Biden is to the right of Obama?
Yeah.
Must we remind people of this all the time? It's going to be even more corporate.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm getting negative vibes off of you, but I will just say, as someone who prioritizes dealing with climate change, when I think of the climate crisis, I think of John Kerry. Anyway, quick responses to some more names. Mike Bloomberg to possibly head the World Bank.
Do I pick up my computer and throw it at my wall?
That would be a response.
TYT might get mad because I broke my most recent one with coffee. But
that's true.
Yeah, that's I'm restraining myself. That's horrible. Look, we just delineated how racist, how paternalistic, how right-wing Mike Bloomberg is. But because he's probably going to donate hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, to the Biden campaign in the general election, which when it would be moot because of free media, and Hillary had more money than Trump. Oh my God, and she lost. Yep. Okay, because of that, now we're going to basically allow him to buy himself a position on the World Bank.
Great. Basically. It's up for sale.
Why are you doing this to my blood pressure, John?
Well, let's see. Maybe you like one of these.
Okay.
Elizabeth Warren as Treasury Secretary to help unify the party.
Never, ever, ever gonna happen. Never going to happen. Look, the other people he's considering are Jamie Dimon and some other banker. So mm-hmm. The three names floated out there: two big bankers, and then one person who's known to rail against the bankers. Oh, please don't insult our intelligence by saying you're going to actually put Elizabeth Warren as Treasury Secretary. You're doing this to make sure that people in her camp kind of stand down and don't demand that she endorse Bernie Sanders. Not that she would anyway, but what a joke. It's infantilizing. He would never, ever, ever put Elizabeth Warren in that position. I promise you.
Okay, well, what about this? You know, because we want someone who's qualified for these positions, so I'm gonna jump one ahead. Biden advisors expect Pete Buttigieg to get a prominent slot, perhaps as ambassador to the UN or as US trade representative, both positions that he's qualified for? What does he have to do with? He was the mayor of South Bend. He's gonna be in charge, well, not in charge, but all trade internationally or world diplomacy. That's where I see young Pete.
Oh my God. I mean, this is really the olden days where you can truly buy yourself a position with an endorsement. It's not the best person for the job. It's the person who gave Biden the most political capital at the time. But this is all fantasy land because Biden's probably going to lose to Trump if he's the nominee, right?
That's the fear. Yeah, when Pete Buttigieg said that he would not put a ban on giving people ambassadorships after donating his campaign, most people thought that would be with him as president. Maybe that was just setting up a standard for after he lost.
Right.
God. Anyway, so Biden has picked up some important endorsements, and that's what we'll turn to after this break.
Decided that I am with great enthusiasm going to endorse Joe Biden for president of the United States. I believe in Joe.
So I've always been a fan of the show don't tell school of writing. So I would say if you're going to do it with great enthusiasm, do it with great enthusiasm. Don't just say that it's with great enthusiasm. But that is Senator Kamala Harris endorsing Joe Biden. And Emma Vigeland joins us once again. Emma, how big will this endorsement be?
California already voted. It's only going to reinforce all of the people who are already going to vote for Joe Biden. The fact that establishment people are lining up behind him, that's a huge part of it for them. I think the Buttigieg and Klobuchar endorsements were way bigger because they were already in the race and it happened right before Super Tuesday. Obviously, we saw how the results panned out remarkably terribly for Bernie Sanders. Did quite well for Joe Biden in ways I never could have expected, to be honest with you. I was dead wrong. So look, I mean, this is really the establishment striking back. And I'm just shocked that after these candidates were bringing up such specific, I mean, Kamala Harris very famously arguments against Joe Biden about his long history where he opposed busing. And that little girl was me, one of the most memorable moments of the primary, to enthusiastically support Joe Biden. Like they don't have principles in many ways, and they're hoping to gain something for themselves. And mostly they're hoping to stop Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. You know, it's so weird that all of these candidates who stood on the debate stage and said, Bernie likes to say that he's like the only progressive. No, we're all actually progressive. We're the real progressive. All of them have endorsed the moderate candidate. So weird how that
worked
out.
Great point, John. That was such a good point.
Thank you. I'm smart. But anyway, so I want to get your read on the reason she said she waited until now to do the endorsement, and my theory of why it actually was. So she said, I had two women colleagues in the race and I did not feel right putting my thumb on the scale that in any way would harm their candidacy. So when Elizabeth announced that she was getting out of the race, I let Joe know that I would endorse him. So she's saying she wouldn't endorse until there were no women because she didn't want to hurt a female candidate. I would argue that if her endorsement was going to really matter, it was going to matter for California. But it looked like Bernie Sanders was going to win California anyway. And so why would she endorse Joe Biden and then have it look like her endorsement didn't matter? This seems to me to be more about protecting herself rather than protecting Klobuchar and Warren.
Oh, absolutely. And there was a window between when Klobuchar dropped out and Warren did. So if this was your feminist rah-rah moment, why didn't you endorse Elizabeth Warren before Super Tuesday? You could have done that, Kamala Harris. And again, this toothless corporate feminism is so frustrating. It really takes away from legitimate fights for feminist ideals and principles and female equality to just be like, you know, it was all about their gender. It's about the policies. And this doesn't resonate with anyone except for upper middle class, upper class, more elitist feminists who just want to, you know, put the hashtag on Twitter and don't have it affect their lives or go to the Women's March and take an Instagram, whatever. This is not about electoral politics and how it connects with people and how it affects people's lives. This is just kind of like saying, oh, I was just going to support a woman or whatever. Again, as I said before, it's toothless and it's honestly a turnoff for the general electorate. It may play in kind of upper crust elitist liberal circles, but it certainly doesn't play with a majority of voters, in my view.
Maybe. Now, Harris was not the only one who endorsed him. Cory Booker, another one of the true progressives who just had disagreements with Bernie Sanders. It wasn't that he was actually a moderate pretending to be a progressive. He has endorsed Joe Biden as well, which in both of these cases, so you mentioned the I was that girl line. For Cory Booker, people are bringing up, like we talked about the, you know, Cory Booker expressing concern for Joe Biden's mental state and all of that. But you also had this old tweet from June of last year resurrecting itself when a woman named Emily said, me realizing I'm going to have to vote for Joe Biden in 2020 and looking sad, and Cory Booker retweeting it with, no, you won't.
Well,
how the turntables. No, anyway.
Have turned, yes. Right. But no, it looks like, yeah, he's now saying you will have to vote for Joe Biden if you agree with me. It goes to show how institutionally corrupt the Democratic Party is. And obviously, I think Democrats are way better than Republicans. They're both corrupt. I get it. But the Republicans are just nakedly beholden to corporate interests and to wealthy people. The Democrats would improve lives on the whole. Mm-hmm. That's my position. But when it comes to the structure of the National Democratic Party, of the DNC, institutionally, it is more corrupt than the Republicans because of really just the superdelegate point, as well as this blowback from the establishment. Donald Trump was who the base wanted in 2016. And a lot of the Republican establishment wasn't happy about it, but they didn't actively coalesce to really block Donald Trump from being the nominee. It's not exactly analogous, but the superdelegates, the institutional structure of the party, because Bernie Sanders threatens corporate interests in the way Trump obviously didn't, and no Republican candidate did, the Democratic Party is so terrified that they have to have these candidates coalesce and that they weren't able to get rid of the undemocratic superdelegates that were designed as a failsafe to block Bernie Sanders if he were the nominee.
Exactly. Let's turn to one other topic. Joe Biden was on with Lawrence O'Donnell last night, and the question of what he would do if Medicare for All were passed and were put on his desk, how would he respond to that? I think this is something everyone needs to see.
Veto anything that delays providing the security and the certainty of health care being available now. If they got that through and by some miracle, and there was an epiphany that occurred, and some miracle occurred that said, okay, it's passed, then you got to look at the cost. I want to know, how did they find the $35 trillion? What is that doing? Is it going to significantly raise taxes on the middle class? Which it will. What's going to happen? Look, my opposition isn't to the principle that there should be, you should have Medicare. I mean, healthcare should be a right in America. My opposition relates to whether or not, A, it's doable, two, what the cost is, and what the consequences for the rest of the budget are. How are you going to find $35 trillion over the next 10 years?
So, look, many people took that video to mean that he is going to veto Medicare for All if it somehow passes with him as the figurehead of the Democratic Party. And some Biden defenders have responded by saying, well, that's not exactly what he's saying. And I say to them, him cloaking that whole thing in a whole bunch of right-wing talking points against Medicare for All does not make me feel more generous towards him on Medicare for All. It makes me feel more like he's likely to veto it. All that nonsense about, you know, I want to make sure that it doesn't stop people from getting health care now. What formulation of Medicare for All takes away people's health insurance without immediately replacing it with something else? That's just a fantasy.
Well, this is what happens when the front runner in the Democratic race is someone who fetishizes compromise and working with Republicans and being a middle ground candidate. Again, he was to the right of Obama in 2008. He remains to the right of Obama. He remains in many respects to the right of Hillary Clinton. At least she pretended to care about passing progressive policy when Bernie Sanders was in the race and tried to at least give him some sort of crumbs when she was the nominee to adopt some of the principles. I mean, notably, she actually did adopt some really good principles of his when it came to College for All and education. So I will commend her there. Biden, I guarantee you, will not be interested in that. Not at all. And that's just going to show you that clip shows you that exactly. To veto legislation, if we were able to get that monumental victory for working class people, for Americans in general, passed, and you were saying that you, as the head of the Democratic Party, as the figurehead, you would nix that legislation after the Senate and the House put in so much work into passing it, and that would guarantee health care for all. And again, going back on that right-wing talking point and saying that, oh, you know, the trillions of dollars that we raise on the middle class and middle class tax increase, it is less than what they're paying in premiums and deductibles. Stop it. Stop gaslighting us. Yeah. And again, I just feel like this whole week I've been blackpilled. I'm being gaslit all the time. Oh, he's the best nominee against Trump. Like, are you trying to get us to just close our eyes, close our ears, pretend like this is, you know, 1972 and Biden is still this fiery politician? He can't talk. He's not a good communicator, and he's completely behind the times on everything where the general public is, not just where the Democratic Party is, but the electorate has become so shell-shocked and stricken with PTSD because of Donald Trump that we're really going to revert back to this guy. It's a bad, bad, bad idea. I want Trump out of office more than anything. But wow, are we really going to do this? I guess we'll see tonight.
I guess we'll see tonight. Little historical footnote for people looking back on this election. You have two candidates right now, one who supports Medicare for All, one who says that he might literally veto it if it somehow still passes, despite the fact that in every state that has voted so far, there is support for a government plan for health insurance to replace private insurance. It has won in every single state, except that a lot of those people then say, and that's why I'm supporting Joe Biden.
And by the way, if Biden's the nominee, they're going to blame Bernie Sanders supporters, guarantee you. And no one will, and people will not admit that Bernie could have beat Donald Trump if he's not the nominee. Yeah. They won't admit it. Biden will, and the Democratic establishment will still blame the left. Fun times we're living in. Yep. Okay.
Thanks for joining us, Emma. I'm sure we've got your day off to a great start, so thank you.
Well, it's 1:40 here, so it's not necessarily a start, but I'm angry.
I always forget that you guys live in the future. Okay, maybe we'll see you during the coverage later on, but thank you again.
All right, thanks guys.
Okay, we'll be back in just a few. One of the unfortunately rarely discussed consequences of the massive gender gap in a variety of different metrics internationally is that in some countries, women commit suicides at incredibly high rates. That is certainly the case in recent years, getting even worse in India. And joining us now to discuss this issue and some of the potential causes for it, Nilanjana Baumick, independent journalist and women's rights advocate. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hello there.
Glad to have you on. I wanted to talk about this article that you wrote, "Are Indian Women Killing Themselves Because Indian Men Are Lazy?" So tell me about sort of the thesis behind this article.
So, you know, the Lancet calls it Indian women committing suicides. You know, it's a public health crisis. I call it, you know, since 2010, you know, I've been talking about this, you know, it's one of the worst gender crisis, you know, in this country. And yes, you know, my thesis is that, you know, it is overwork that's killing Indian women, because, you know, Indian women, Indian men are among the laziest in the world. Yes, you heard me right. Indian women do 10 times more, you know, like unpaid care work than Indian men. And that is 3 times the global average.
Wow. Also,
you know, Indian men spend 48 hours in paid and unpaid work, while Indian women spend 62 hours. Now, when you take all of this, you know, into account, and you take into account, you know, our patriarchal nature of society, which places an inordinate amount of pressure on women, you know, to do everything, you are looking at, as I already said, a crisis, a gender crisis of unimaginable magnitude. But, you know, we are not really talking about this. We are not really, you know, we are talking about the suicides. You know, we are talking about, you know, how more than 20,000 women have been killing themselves in this country every year. But we are not really looking at the root causes, you know, like where it all begins from.
Wow. And just for people's context, you refer to that Lancet study. It says that globally, women commit suicide at lower rates than men. But in India, it's 4 times higher for women, which is insane, the fact
yeah.
that it's been increasing recently.
Yeah.
So I believe that you sort of alluded to this, but the concept of super womanhood and the pressure that it can put on women. Tell me a little bit about that.
So, you know, there is this, you know, we are a modern society now, you know, but I feel that we are not equipped to be a modern society in the sense that, you know, we are a modern society. I was, you know, having this conversation, you know, with a friend of mine in the US, and she was telling me that a lot of women in the US feel that, you know, the modern Indian woman is a better place because they do have it all, because, you know, they have a family support. And also, you know, in India, as you know, we can, you know, we have the concept of hired domestic helpers. But the point is that, you know, it is, you know, the joint family system doesn't exist anymore. You know, we are a modern society now, and more, you know, like families are, you know, we have more nuclear families now. And the other thing is that, you know, only a very small percentage of women can actually, you know, afford hired help. So when we are talking about having it all, that is not true. In India, you know, in the modern Indian woman, you know, is expected to go out to work to be a co-breadwinner. But then, you know, we haven't created any institutional backups for them. Like, you know, we do not have enough, you know, daycare centers. The daycare centers that we have, you know, for working women to keep their children there while they're at work, you know, are very expensive, you know, and mm-hmm. the state-run daycare centers, you know, are very less in numbers. And so, you know, we do not have the institutional backup that can, you know, help and support women to go out to work. So what is happening is that, you know, a woman is going out to work and then she's coming back and she is doing everything at home as well. Because, you know, as I said, you know, given our patriarchal nature of society, men, housework is considered feminine. So mm-hmm. it is solely a woman's responsibility. Care work, you know, cooking, cleaning, you know, it is solely a woman's responsibility. Very few families, you know, even in the most progressive of families, you know, the kitchen is always the woman's responsibility. So what that in effect means is that we do not have it all. We are actually doing it all and we are doing it alone.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, it's been a little bit of time since that Lancet study came out. Have you seen anything, even maybe the beginnings of sort of a recognition of this domestically in India? Are there things changing that give you hope that this situation might change, the trend might change?
I mean, you know, change will only come, you know, when we change our society, when our society begins to value women and women's work. You know, women's work is not valued in this country because, you know, I'm just going to give you a very small example. You know, you must have heard, you know, a lot about farmer suicides. A lot of, you know, like farmers, you know, commit suicide in India. And you'll be surprised to know that among these farmer suicides, you know, a lot of these farmers are actually women farmers. And, you know, I've spent time with, you know, women farmers, you know, in rural areas, and they are not given the respect of being a farmer. No one calls them a farmer. Although the fact is that, you know, they spend as much time, you know, on their fields along with their husbands, you know, as their male relatives do. I spent, you know, like a week, you know, with a woman farmer, you know, in a village, and her day started from like 3 a.m. in the morning. You know, she did all the housework, you know, she looked after the livestock, and then, you know, cooked and cleaned, and then she went to the field, you know, with her husband, and she walked in the field the entire day, and then she came back and she did all the housework again. And it was just mind-boggling, you know, to see the amount of work. And it's not, you know, and it's also normalized in our society. Like, you know, I have grown up, you know, seeing my mom do everything. She was a, you know, like a police officer, you know, she had a very high-pressured job, but, you know, she did everything at home as well. And, you know, I grew up most of my life not understanding, you know, that, you know, she has a very important job. For me, you know, she was like a housewife because, you know, I always saw her doing things around the house. And the time that she was not in the house was a time, you know, where I didn't see, you know, what she was doing. So it came as quite a surprise to me when I once visited her in her office, and everyone was like calling her like ma'am, and they were like doing things for her, and I was like, oh, that's my mom, right? And so what I'm saying is that, you know, we have to go back, right, you know, to the beginning, and, you know, like teach our boys, you know, that A, that housework is gender neutral, and that, you know, housework is a life skill. You know, it's not feminine, or, you know, it doesn't have gender, and it is a life skill that, you know, they need to learn as well. And I think, you know, like we have to, you know, Indian textbooks, you know, like say for example school textbooks are also, you know, like have these gender stereotypes where women are portrayed as, you know, someone who takes care of the family, and men as, you know, macho. If you look at our Bollywood, you know, like everyone knows about Bollywood, you know, that the way, you know, like women are portrayed in our movies are also like, you know, they're damsels in distress, you know, someone, you know, who looks after the home, you know, even if they're working. And men are, you know, supposed to be like this protectors, this, you know, people, you know, like men are, you know, the protectors. So that has to change, you know. I mean, like, as I wrote in my article as well, that, you know, women have become co-breadwinners, but men are yet to become co-spouses. So they have to understand that the house is their responsibility as well. Housework is their responsibility as well. I mean, look at our ads also, you know. Child is always running to the mother, you know, like for food or, you know, for whatever, you know. I mean, like, you never see, you know, like men, you know, cooking in advertisements. And these are popular culture, right? This is what, you know, we are growing up, you know, seeing and reading. We are seeing the behavior of our fathers at home, you know. They're sitting in a chair, you know, reading the newspaper, drinking cups of tea, being served their food, and the mother is in the kitchen, you know. And it's something, you know, it has become a part of our culture. You know, I call it a culture in crisis. Our culture is really in a crisis, and we need to really wake up and, you know, like start looking at our homes before we can, you know, change policies and make laws. You know, we have all of that. You know, we have great laws, we have great policies. We need to go back and look into our homes and, you know, start making changes there.
I couldn't agree more, and I appreciate you joining us and breaking this down. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about some of the solutions in the future, but thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. So that is just about all the time we have. I did want to let you know that if you haven't already rated the podcast on Apple Podcasts, we would really appreciate you doing that. We've gotten some great ones recently, including one from Lord of the Asylum, who said, "Really enjoy John and the other great people who pop in. Informative and good pacing of segments. I highly recommend it. 3.5 stars. Could have done all the stars if you loved it that much. But no, we really do appreciate it. Even criticism, mild, is accepted. Thank you everybody for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.